I slide my ring finger from Senegal to South Carolina and feel the ocean separate a million families. The soft hum of history spins on its tilted axis. A cavalcade of ghost ships wash their hands of all they carry.
Clint Smith is a writer and doctoral candidate at Harvard University, and he wrote several poems for the New York Times' 1619 Project. Clint, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
I started thinking about this idea of empathy in Black Americans back in 2017. I wrote a piece for CNN about it, and I started that piece with W.E. Du Bois's writings, in which he says, there have been, for instance, few other cases in the history of civilized peoples where human suffering has been viewed with such peculiar indifference. Clint, where does that indifference stem from when we talk about the suffering of Black Americans?
Yeah, I think that quote is so profound and so accurate. I think, you know, part of the insidiousness of racism is that the lack of empathy for Black Americans stems from a myriad of different places. I think what is so wonderful about the 1619 issue is that it kind of talks about a little bit of that. And something that I've been thinking a lot about is the history of pseudoscience and the history of eugenics and the history that made it so that so many people throughout civilization, you know, across Western civilization, even in a post-Enlightenment and perhaps most insidiously in a post-Enlightenment era, believed that Black people did not feel physical pain in the same way. And that's outlined in a wonderful essay by Linda Villarosa. And then there's also the, you know, we can go back to Jefferson. He is, in essence, the paragon of American ideals. He represents the best of American aspirations, and he is the intellectual founding father of this country. And he is also someone who enslaved 600 people. He's also someone who enslaved his own children. He's also someone who wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia that Black people did not possess the same level of intellectual or emotional acumen as their white counterparts, that they did not have the emotional capacity with which to create art. I think those are part of the origin story of a lack of empathy that continued to blossom throughout history. If you don't understand the history of public policy and how it shaped these communities, what happens is then you can look at certain communities and fall into the trap, even for well-intentioned folks, fall into the trap of thinking that the people who live there somehow deserve the conditions that they have found themselves in, that it is somehow their fault, that it is somehow a result of a cultural or genetic or biological inferiority, rather than things that have been done to those communities generation after generation after generation.
I want to bring that to where we are today to a certain extent. I mean, on this program, we've discussed how President Trump's rhetoric around certain issues, whether it's Black Americans, Latino Americans, Latino migrants, has emboldened white supremacists. How much does that rhetoric play into what we're seeing today in a lack of empathy towards Black Americans specifically?
I think it plays a huge role. I mean, I think that we should be clear that it does not begin and does not end with the president. But I think we should also be clear that he fuels the flames and the sort of sentiments that have sort of existed in the underbelly of so many parts of this country and for millions of people in this country have now been brought to the fore. And in many ways, he's far more explicit than so many of his predecessors have ever been. And to be clear, you know, that does not mean that people who came before him were not instituting policies that were imbued with systemic racism and structural racism and reinforced a lot of the harmful public policies that impact Black communities. But we can't underestimate and overstate the extent to which President Trump's rhetoric has played a huge role in saturating the discourse in a way that other folks who have come before him more recently have not done so.
Clint, we asked some of our listeners what they were taught about slavery in school. And one person said, quote, "It's time to get over it." How do we acknowledge or even respond to that? Do we have to respond to that?
Yeah. So the way that I think about this is that there are two groups of folks. I think there are folks who you can provide them with all of the facts that you want that demonstrate the role that slavery has played in shaping the contemporary landscape of inequality in this country, and they won't care. It won't matter to them. But I do think that there is a group of people, and I think that this has become clear over the past several days in which people have been talking about how much they've learned from the 1619 Project from the New York Times. There are a group of people who simply don't know. You know, I always give this timeline. The first enslaved Africans came to this country in 1619. The Emancipation Proclamation happened in 1863. Civil War ended in 1865. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act were 1964 and 1965. Federal Housing Act was 1968. So it's only been about 50 years in which black people in this country have even had a semblance of legal and legislative freedom. For 350 years prior to that, it was fundamentally legal to discriminate against, dehumanize, delegitimize, and disenfranchise black people. Not in the interpersonal, somebody being mean and using the N-word, but you are a state section, second-class citizen, if considered a citizen at all. So if you were to kick somebody for 350 years, and then you stop kicking them, ostensibly, for a seventh of the amount of time that you spent kicking them, it would be both morally and intellectually disingenuous to then look at that group of people and be like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you have the same economic outcomes? Why is there so much violence and poverty in your community? But we have convinced ourselves that this history is somehow a long time ago when it wasn't actually that long ago at all. I was interviewing my grandmother not too long ago. There was a moment in which my daughter, who's 6 months old, was sitting on her lap, and she was telling me about how she used to sit on her grandfather's lap. And her grandfather is the person who raised her, and her grandfather was someone who was born into slavery. It was this profound moment in which I realized that, you know, my daughter was sitting on the lap of someone who sat on the lap of someone who was born into bondage. And that is the lineage of my family. And that is, slavery is so, still so alive in my lineage. And I think that we forget, with all the black and white videos and all of the images in our textbooks, some of which are there and aren't there, I think we can convince ourselves that something happened a long time ago when it actually didn't happen that long ago at all.
You mentioned the black and white videos, and I think a lot of us, we sort of see that as part of our cultural narrative, our cultural mythology in this country. And I almost think we can sort of pack, a lot of people say, well, we'll pack that up, we'll put that back in the 1960s and we'll move on. But the media showed those videos. The media has also had a role in perpetrating a lack of empathy for communities of color and black communities in particular, when we think about the welfare queen, crack babies, et cetera. Bringing that to today, I mean, the media writ large is also in the hands of everyday Americans. And what I mean by that is we have cell phones, we have Facebook Live, we have now taken things that used to be considered either over or not even happening and put them at the forefront of our vision. And when we see videos of black Americans just in the past couple of years, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, the list goes, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, when we see videos of black Americans being killed by police, does that increase our empathy for black communities since we're no longer able to look away?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I think this is something that I and many other folks have wrestled with over the course of the past several years, in which the emergence of these videos has become has saturated our media landscape more and more. It's hard to say. I think there's certainly something to be said for providing evidence and a sort of continuous stream of evidence that black people have not been lying for the past three centuries about the conditions that we've experienced, about our relationship to law enforcement, about how law enforcement treats us as compared to other communities. I think there for a long time, people simply didn't believe it. I do worry about what the constant inundation of videos of black people being harmed and black people being killed and black people being beaten. At what point is it increasing empathy? And at what point is it desensitizing us to the pain and suffering that black people are experiencing? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that this is something that scholars have been increasingly thinking about. But I think that is the tension, a recognition that these videos and everything around them have certainly contributed to a different type of dialogue, a different level of dialogue about racism in this country, but also at what cost? How is that impacting the health of so many people in a sort of long-term way? And is it, how do you find the balance between illuminating harsh realities and also not desensitizing ourselves to the violence that this world continues to enact on us?
We want to tie everything together, and I know that's really hard to do, but I'm wondering if you could tell us briefly, what will it take for us as a nation to have more empathy for each other?
I think those of us who, like yourself and like me, who think about these things all the time, can take for granted how many people don't know this information that feels very basic to many of us, but that is so central to the American story. And I do think, you know, it is not in our control. I have no way of knowing if when somebody reads about the myriad of different ways that public policy has decimated Black communities, that next time they drive past a community that is destitute and a community that is populated largely by Black people, will that shift their relationship to that community? Will that shift the way that they make a set of decisions about their own lives and how that impacts other people? I don't know. I think for some people it will be a transformative thing that shifts their personal and political lives. And I think for others, they might learn it and then it might stay there. But I do know that we have to begin by this sort of this process of national reckoning, national education, in order to move to the next step. We have to continue pushing to ensure that the conversation does not simply stay at the, oh, wow, I didn't know this, that's so sad, but then moves from that space into, okay, what are we going to do about it now?
Clint Smith is a scholar and the author of Counting Dissent and the forthcoming nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed. Clint, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And we wanted to leave you with the words of one of Clint Smith's poems featured in the 1619 Project from the New York Times.
Over the course of 350 years, 36,000 slave ships crossed the Atlantic Ocean. I walk over to the globe and move my finger back and forth between the fragile continents. I try to keep count of how many times I drag my finger across the bristled hemispheres, but grow weary of chasing a history that swallowed me. For every 100 people who were captured and enslaved, 40 died before they ever reached the New World. I pull my index finger from Angola to Brazil and feel the bodies jumping from the ship. I drag my thumb from Ghana to Jamaica and feel the weight of dysentery make an anvil of my touch. I slide my ring finger from Senegal to South Carolina and feel the ocean separate a million families. The soft hum of history spins on its tilted axis. A cavalcade of ghost ships wash their hands of all they carry.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.